Welcome to Hollywood and Horsepower, the show about the story behind the story. Today we are joined by a very special guest, somebody that is known in many different industries for many different things, Shannon White. Shannon is known to a lot of people in the thoroughbred industry, sport horse industry, and also equine medicine. And I am sure everyone feels that she is the rock star in every one of those, and the reality is she's been the rock star in all of them. So, Shannon, welcome to the show. We really appreciate you joining us today.
And well, we're excited to talk to you. Thank you so much. That's very kind of you to say.
So I wanted to go back, and I'm sure you get asked this a million times a month, but, you know, kind of take us back to the beginning of your career, because I really think that you have one of those careers that a lot of people think they know you for this, and the reality is you've done a lot more than probably anyone realizes.
Well, that's true. I think, you know, the horse industry in general is very secular. You know, we thoroughbred people and quarter horse people and show jumping people, you know, we don't commingle all that often. And so, you know, I've been very fortunate at different times in my life, you know, to explore and build a career that's based on that's pretty multifaceted, honestly. And I'm still growing and changing. And I think that's what makes, you know, the horse industry so dynamic and so wonderful. The people you meet, but most importantly, the horses you meet along the way.
I would agree. I think it's a very compartmentalized industry. And I think that, you know, that's changing a little. It seems like the world is opening up some, because I think you see horses that move between some of the disciplines. So they may have started out as a racehorse and they end up in sport horse or something else. So sometimes people get a little exposure. But I think over your career, it's especially been true that, you know, you were really well known in a lot of different aspects, going all the way back to when, you know, you were with Root and Riddle. And then
Right. Coming
up to, you know, breeding some of the biggest names in the industry. And, you know, so how did you get started? Like, when did you decide you wanted to work in, you know, equine medicine or equine science? And I'm not
well,
sure I'm giving
always...
it a proper name.
Sure. Well, I've always loved horses. And I think that's something you're born with, honestly. And I think that's pretty typical for a lot of girls and boys growing up. And my stepdad was in the Navy, so I couldn't own horses, you know, and 8, 9, 10 years old, I collected briars. I mean, it's the typical story, right? And
Sure. So
when we moved back to Kentucky, I bought a little quarter horse mare and started showing her in AQHA events and county fair shows, 4-H shows. 4-H was a very, very big part of my foundation, and I'm forever indebted to 4-H programs and to the Extension Service through the University of Kentucky. I had wonderful mentors there, great opportunities for public speaking and demonstrations. If you're familiar with 4-H at all, it is a wonderful program, grassroots program. And through there, that
it's
led
so
me.
So interesting you bring that up, because I started the same way. So I was in 4-H all the way through school, FFA, and in FFA I did public speaking, which probably explains some of what I do today. So you know, you started out, you know, obviously in Kentucky, and you were fortunate enough to be able to go to the University of Kentucky, and
yes.
You know, that was your so your focus was already on equine science and management at that point.
Oh, always. And my dad was, and my grandfather, my uncles, I mean, they were, I can remember being very young watching races at Hialeah Park and the Florida Derby and, you know, Gato del Sol and just Holy Bull. I grew up watching them, and at the track, we were at Keeneland frequently, sometimes the Red Mile, but, you know, I grew up on my dad's leg there at Keeneland. And so the pedigrees in the racing industry was always very intriguing, but I didn't really have a modality to explore that really until much later in my career. And so it started with quarter horses and local shows, and then in high school I don't know if I told you this, Mark, but, you know, I never snuck out of the house for boys or parties. And you have to take this back. This is in the late 80s. And so we had, you know, the days of Encyclopedia Britannica, and all of your information came from publications. And so Then it was the Quarter Horse Journal, and there were these wonderful articles by Dr. Ed Squires, Colorado State University, on embryo transfer, which I thought was just fascinating. And so I spent some time with Dr. Villahaus in Lexington at Bluegrass Embryo Transfer Labs. This was in the, 86, 87. And I was maybe junior high school then, or freshman in high school, but I ended up, you'll get a kick out of this, doing my 4-H demonstration on embryo transfer, which at the time was pretty revolutionary.
Oh, that's so funny. That was very revolutionary.
Yeah, but...
I remember that, because we were just exploring that with cattle at that time. The same time period... It was just beginning to be known within. I was raised on a beef farm, and, you know, that was something that was just starting to happen. Some of the big names, you know, out west, you know, some of the big ranches that everyone knows were doing it with some of the more popular bulls. And, yeah, so that was cutting edge, so that's pretty cool.
Yeah, and I'll share pictures with you when we leave the podcast. It's pretty funny. I found them, but I mean, those were the days when we had permed hair, right? And the big bangs, and so that was, you know, taking it way back. But they were opening a new hospital in Lexington, Kentucky, called Rudin Riddle Equine Hospital. And, you know, I caught little bits and pieces, and as it so happened, we had a horse trailer that we sold to a lady named Val Kleinheit. And Val was the midnight to eight supervisor at Rudin Riddle. And I said, gosh, you know, I'd sure love to come work there. And I was 17 at the time, and she needed neonatal full techs, you know, we call it full patrol. And growing up, I had shown, you know, we'd had horses with the Kovalik family there in Clark County, Kentucky. And, you know, so they were familiar. The practice was just opening its doors. And she said, you know, if you want to come work for me. And my parents said, absolutely not. You know, I'd never driven out of Clark County. And I, you know, nothing doing. I had a little Nissan Sentra, and I would pop the clutch. We lived on the top of the hill. I'd pop the clutch going down the driveway so I wouldn't wake my parents. And for months, I actually would sneak off to work midnight to eight at Rudin Riddle between my high school and freshman year of college. And I actually ended up with a foal that had a seizure, and I got kicked in the head. I was 17.
Oh, my goodness.
And Dr. Dave Stevens, who was an intern at the time, drove me to St. Joe, but they couldn't actually suture my forehead without consent from my parents. And so we had to call my mother at like 3 a.m, tell her I'm in the emergency room at St. Joe. I'm okay. I explained what had happened. And so he said, well, you know, at least let us get good tires on your car. And at least we know where you are. This is predated cell phones, so they had no idea where I was.
News is your daughter wasn't at an all-night rave. The bad news is she got kicked in the head by a horse.
Yeah. I actually still have the scar to prove it. But, you know, Dr. Bernard was there at the time, and neonatal medicine was emerging. My mother was in medical sales. And so, you know, we did some exciting things. We were working with surfactants with the new Bolton Center, omeprazole, which is now Gastrogard. We were doing all the original work with new Bolton when you had to use a nasogastric tube to administer it. And Drs. Bramlage and Drs. Embertson were there, and they were just, you know, really, really phenomenal mentors. Very, very fortunate.
Yeah, these are big names.
Yeah, 10 years, you know, under their tutelage, and just the care and compassion in that clinic. You know, there was great camaraderie. We had great technicians and interns still. And fast forward to my life now, you know, my daughter is now working for Dr. Jen Jordan at Rudin Riddle here in Wellington, Florida. And so it's come full circle.
And Rudin Riddle is such a great group of people. We don't promote a lot on the show, but we do promote Old Friends Farm in Lexington, Kentucky. Equine, you're familiar with them. And Rudin Riddle has been gracious enough to help them for years, as has many other clinics and hospitals and veterinarians.
Sure, sure. And I think you have a good Dr. Metcalf.
And, you know, the king of it was going back to the beginning, and you probably knew him, was Dave Byers, Dr. Byers.
Yes, he was
Doug
wonderful.
Byers, I'm sorry. He was brilliant.
Doug Byers. You know, that's right.
Doug Byers, and he was brilliant. You know, he was one of the, and I think if you look at a lot of these guys, they looked and studied a lot of human medicine and then applied it to equine.
You bet. You bet. It, absolutely. Everything. You know, I remember when we actually got the first scintigraphy unit in Lexington, and, you know, that was pretty revolutionary, but and that's exactly what it's from. It's been adapted from the human field. And so seeing that, I mean, can you think back to where we started and how far we've come? It's pretty exciting to know that we have, you know, the diagnostic ability that we have now, and obviously we're continuing to perfect that in multiple fields for the betterment of the horse. But, you know, those great guys, I have to say this, not only are they great because they have this astounding body of knowledge and this experience, but they care. And I would say that to students all the time. The one thing that differentiates really wonderful practitioners, they're empathetic, you know, to the owners and the situation, and they care. And that is something you can't teach people. You can't train people, you know. And so when you see Dr. Byers and the Embertsons and Bramwich and Riddle, the world, I mean, they care. And, you know,
that is... You say that because that same thing applies to, like, trainers, owners. The people that genuinely care, you can just see it comes through. And they're the ones that, you know... You really feel good when they excel. I mean, you know, they just, you know, it, you can tell that they truly love it, and they love what they're doing, and they're doing it, you know, for the right reasons. And that's always nice. And
it's continuous improvement. Nice. That's right.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you know, there's so many, like, I know you know Dr. Brian Waldridge. He's the one that comes to mind like that. You know, just, you know, the kindest human being you'll ever meet in your life. He'd do anything for anybody. He's now a professor at Auburn and still helps out, you know, multiple, you know, farms in Kentucky. Just a brilliant guy. But, yes, it is interesting that the people that you see that rise to the top always have that same empathy and just a genuine
absolutely
care.
And they're compassionate, and they share that enthusiasm, they share that passion with their students. And so now what you have, we just had the AAEP convention, of course, in Orlando, and had a chance to reconnect with a lot of people from my past and see them. But they, you know, generational sharing of their knowledge and experiences, and that is just empowering. It's exciting to see, and very, very fortunate
for
that.
So for the people outside our industry, what is AAEP? Tell them a little bit about that, because a lot of our listeners...
Oh, sure. AAEP is the American Association, of equine practitioners. So it's an annual meeting of equine veterinarians and technicians.
That's great. So you attended that, and I understand your daughter attended it as well.
She did. She is launching, she's working with a company called Sitter. It's a wound care company, but it's a technology that we're pretty excited about. And so we carried that product there to meet with the distributors, had great interaction with those people. I always think it's nice to, you know, the digital age is upon us, but it's always nice to share a handshake and spend some time explaining the technology. And this is kind of exciting because it's a modality you can impregnate, you know, with antibiotics and treat topically situations where systemic levels aren't compatible, sometimes with life. And so, again, came from the, you know, human field and adapted for veterinary medicine.
That's so great. So what's the name of the company again? We don't mind giving shameless plugs here. So what's
Well, we'll send samples. It's Sitter, S-I-D-R. And it's now owned by people who are involved in the thoroughbred racing industry from Saudi Arabia. They bought the technology and moved forward with it. And we're excited to see her. She's worked hard to get to market. Now we're finally ready to go. So it's nice to get to join her and introduce her now to people who knew her only when I was pregnant with her.
That's so
26
cool.
26 years later, she emerges.
So you're at Root and Riddle, and you're established, you're moving up. And then, you know, you end up going to Ferris Farm. Tell us how that came about. I mean, you know, that seems
there was a little in between, but interestingly enough, I used to show yearlings for Ferris Farm in college. That was like, you know, your gas and your money. So I actually remember Barbara Rica and her deputy minister, Philly, showing that yearling Philly to Wayne Lucas. Wayne would come by and kind of take his pick, you know, for the horses he wanted to keep. And that yearling ended up becoming sheriff's deputy, who, as you now know, is the Dam of Berlin. Yeah. So, taking it way back, you know, back into the early 90s, was at Ferris Farm, just casually, you know, as we all kind of do, it's a rite of passage in Kentucky. I think you have to work the yearling sales or sales prep or show yearlings. And so I did that for many, many years for a lot of people in the thoroughbred industry to pay my show fees for the quarter horses, quite honestly. So that's where that started. Then, you know, but while I was at Rood & Riddle, you know, I wanted to go back to college and finish my graduate degree. So when my oldest daughter was born, I took a year to finish that degree in vocational education. And I started working actually with Garrett O'Rourke and David Schweitzer and Lori Lawrence, Jackie Smith, Callan Strauss. I'm sure you know some of those names from Judmont. And
oh, yeah, these are big names.
Yeah, UK, but we started a program called the Kentucky Equine Management Internship Program. It was an internship program for post-baccalaureate students and some associate degree students and professional students from other industries to come to live and work in the Lexington thoroughbred industry. And our goal was to recruit articulate, educated people from other disciplines, saddlebreds, you know, quarter horses, you name it. You had these great students who wanted a career path. I just remember being that young student who wanted it so desperately. And what it does, it's a 6-month training course, maybe to 5 months now, but, you know, we bring them in and introduce them to the best management practices. I mean, we spend a lot of time ticking the boxes. We have a breeding season, you know, from January to May, and then we have a yearling breaking and sales prep season from June to November. And it was to bring those students in during those key times on each of the farms. I mean, Lane's End, Judmont, you name it, they all have students, Coolmore, Calumet. And so they're placed and housed on the farms. So they're there for foaling. They're there to take mares to the shed. They're there, you know, for lacerations, emergencies, and then also mucking stalls, because I've always said that if you're an employee in the industry and your aspirations are leadership and management, that you need to value that person who shows up every morning, you know, to clean stalls or to weed eat or to do most, you know, the perfunctory things. No one ever needs to take the work for granted, because it is critically important from the ground that you understand how much time, effort, it takes, you know, to manage a farm and be in that position. And I can say, quite honestly, I've probably cleaned more stalls than anyone who's ever worked. So,
no, I think there's a lot to that. And that's something, you know, the one that stands out to me, I think of Claiborne, because Claiborne always, you know, they even have a particular way that they muck the stalls. And for people that are outside the industry, when they say muck the stalls, it's a in the industry term, and it basically means, you know, pitchfork in hand, you're cleaning out the stall.
100%.
But, you know, Claiborne has a thing, you know, where they basically are, they call it the Claiborne way. You know, they have a unique way for doing everything. And I think the real lesson is just what you're saying. They want people to appreciate what it takes to make this farm work.
Right. And there is a reason, you know, there's a reason. There's quarantine control. There's, you know, manure management. Horses are now considered a point source of pollution. So, you know, all of those steps, there's a process that's involved. And it was important for us to lay down that groundwork for these people coming into our industry. They have a set of skill standards and they have experiences. So each student on each farm has a very similar experience. And so took a great deal of pride. We started with an 800 number, a logo, and I thought, if I was a young student, you know, what do I want to experience? What do I need to experience to understand exactly, you know, my pathway here, if I want to go into academia, if I want to go into research, veterinary medicine? And I have to say, I think the retention rate is over 70%, and they've had kids from over 131 colleges and universities in like 60 countries. I mean, it's crazy good how many great young people. We even had Randy Gilbert, who was recent past president of the Kentucky Thoroughbred Farm Managers Club. And I feel like I've got a couple even, you know, husband-wife teams and even some children to my credit from our early teams, because they met and they married and they're still very, very happy and engaged in the local horse community in Lexington. And so, gosh, that makes you feel good about, you know, making a contribution to a program. But that program's still going, and, you know, Les Danica runs it. She's been there, gosh, I think 25 years maybe, and doing a phenomenal job. Great students coming out, and they're always looking for students. So I would say, if you have an interest, please apply, because you you know, we've had a few students who are like, this isn't for me. And I tell parents, if your son or daughter calls you and says, Mom, I hate this, let them leave. Because you have to commit to, you know, the hours, the work, the lifestyle choice. But it's probably one of the most rewarding things that most of these young you can meet. I mean, they take you to the derby. I think the trainer's dinner, farmers' meeting. So you're ushered in to an industry that, you know, most people only see on the first Saturday in May. So it's really a great experience for them. And but I did that for a number of years. And then in conjunction with that, at the time, Tri Roberts had called from what used to be Lexington Community College. And we wrote a program, a business management curriculum, for associate degree students to bridge into a baccalaureate program. So they had the business background, and we needed people for the front office, you know, at the Jockey Club, at Keeneland, on the farms to book mares. And so my job then was to build a curriculum to teach those folks the vernacular in the horse industry. And so that program, I actually taught there for 2 years, but about that time was when Mr. Ferris called to offer me a position as a full-time manager at Ferris Farm. Wow. And I actually turned it down several times because I love teaching. I love young people, you know, and I was so happy with association with the university and Dr. Lawrence. And I love UK. I'm such a big Blue fan. But so it was hard for me actually to leave. And they just made an offer at that point I couldn't turn down. So I thought, you know, taking all of the experience from Reardon Riddle and the great practitioners that they had there, you know, plus the even the things I had learned, you know, during that time with young people on the farms, if I had all of the resources available and we could build a program utilizing best management practices and put that into motion and see how that works. You know, we were one of the first farms to work with a high-fat, high-fiber diet. It wasn't super cool, you know. And so, but in theory, it worked because we had inherited a large number of horses with clinical developmental orthopedic disease. So knowing what I knew from my time with Framledge and what contributes to that, there's a genetic predisposition, nutrition, exercise component. You know, what could we do, even from a gestational age, to change the outcome? And a remarkable deduction. We reduced our incidence of clinical OCDs from like 40% to less than 6%, I think. I can't remember now. But we worked with Dr. Debbie Spike, who is now the CEO at Reardon Riddle. She was brilliant, reads so many films and has so much knowledge. And so, you know, she came on as part of our team very early on. The wonderful Dr. Laurie Metcalf, Scott Allshreed with us in the beginning, and then Dr. Mariah Schnobrick came after we lost Dr. Michelle LeBlanc. So our specialty, you know, with a lot of those horses, and we were high-risk mares. We had a lot of geriatric mares with early embryonic loss, and so figuring them out, sorting them out, you know, was something that was incredibly fruitful and rewarding for us. And you know, that farm. Of course, we had a stellar group of mares as we built that business over the almost 15 years we were there, but we produced just shy of 10% stakes horses. But it was a credit to the genetics, wow. Obviously.
And that's a huge accomplishment. You know, then, yeah, that's a huge accomplishment because going back, that was a big problem.
Well, that was yeah, something industry that average
I don't
1.9%,
think the industry really got their arms around until about that era.
Yeah, yeah, you know, looking at it. And then we had, we started with that farm in June, of 2001 and operated, got a $500,000 deficit. And then, and it's a beautiful farm. I don't know if you've seen it, but it has 220 stalls and 760 acres and was immaculately kept. And by December of 2004, I think we closed out the year at $2.5 million. And board revenue, and we kept about a 20% margin. We really didn't have a lot of middle management at that point in time. We had Cricket in the office, who was wonderful, and most people in Central Kentucky will remember Cricket. And we had a great veterinary team. We had great staff there. But we had, you know, Mandy Pope had her horses with us for a period of time. Jess and Barbara Jackson, Rich Heinemann, Betty Moran, you know, when Riley closed Eaton, we had all of Mrs. Moran's horses there. And so you get these stellar groups of mares, and I just skip through. Oh, Narvik, I'm trying to think now of the horses that stayed with us, and Mike Ryan, who's a wonderful, wonderful horseman.
Pretty big names that came out of those mares.
You better believe it. Yeah, we had resources come our way and go on to bigger and better things, but probably the most notable, of course, is Curlin. And he's certainly been a treat, such a delight for him, but he wasn't
the
prodigal.
Tell us the story of Curlin, because I know that it wasn't your typical, like, he just, you know, your homebred. There was a lot to him coming together, which it seems like is very common with these real prominent horses.
Well, there's always a story, a good story, and his is kind of special. So 2003, I think, Mark, let me think. Hold on, let me go back here. We closed the farm in Fredericksburg, Texas in 2001, and we had to have all the horses. It was a game farm, and so there were llamas, pronghorn, you know, there were all kinds of interesting animals in Fredericksburg, but we sold that property. I think it was to the drummer for the band Alabama, but all the animals had to leave, and so we had a few mares there. We had a mare named Sheriff's Deputy located in Fredericksburg, and she was in foal to one of, she was in foal to the Mr. Prospector of a Lady Secret that we owned, that stood at King Quirk's Ranch, Q6 Ranch in Texas. When the mare was with Wayne, she'd slabbed a knee at the 3-year-old, and Mr. Ferris sent her back to Texas to support, you know, the regional efforts for this Mr. Prospector out of Lady Secret named Excellent Secret, I think is his name. Boy, I should know that. Anyway, and she had a wild zone on her side, and then she came with two other phone trick mares out from that farm and shipped into Kentucky, and we sold the two phone trick mares but kept Sheriff's Deputy because she had a slab fracture in her left knee. And of course, Deputy Minister was a very credible broodmare sire, and she was a beautiful, big-bodied mare, and she was out of the mare Barbarica that, ironically, Mike Ryan purchased for Mr. Ferris several years prior as a yearling. And she raced for us. She won the Budweiser Breeders' Cup Handicap with Phil Hoswald. And so she was a product of the Ferris Farm program. And so there's sentiment involved. And so she got off the trailer, this gorgeous wild zone, which ironically Donato Lanny bought, I think for George Krikorian, if I'm not mistaken. But I remember Keith Asmussen loved him, thought he was gorgeous. He was absolutely gorgeous. Kentucky bred. Also absolutely beautiful. So here's this mare, big, gorgeous mare. And I thought, boy, oh, if we could really find something special for her. And at the time, Smart Strike was just, he had some nice horses running in Canada. And another horse, I think named Portillus, if I'm not mistaken. I think that was his name. Anyway, bred somewhat similarly. And I only had a $20,000 budget. Taxes and fees were exorbitant. And
Breaking up a little bit.
Yeah. Sorry, Mark, what did you say?
No, you're okay. I know you're at a horse show. For those listening, Shannon works every day of the week, and she's actually doing this graciously enough from a horse show. So bear with us, but I just wanted to let you know you're cutting in and out.
Oh, goodness. Okay, how about here? Is this better?
You know, you're much better. Yeah, you're good. I apologize. I appreciate you doing this. I know your schedule's tight, and
no,
I can't thank you enough for taking the time.
No, happy to do it. But the reception here, we're in Wellington, Florida, literally at the edge of the Everglades at the Wellington International Show facility here. And the service is notoriously bad.
Oh, that's good. So you were telling us about Curlin and his mare. And, you know, what was it that caught your eye that, you know, how did you put that one together?
Well, the interesting thing about this mare, you know, you get mares that are, they give the best of themselves, and you can take some chances physically. You know, with Smart Strike, I'd seen them in all shapes and sizes, to be quite honest. And so, you know, they were turf horses. You could get a smaller, you know, more compact individual, and wasn't terribly prepotent. That's just my opinion or my experiences. But this mare was giving me some really spectacular foals, and so we thought, gosh, if she could replicate that with her big, beautiful body, you know, and the ability of Smart Strike, that, you know, he was pretty versatile. I thought, gosh, that might actually work out well for us. And so I submitted her to Lane's End, and they said, absolutely not, because she's a regional mare. I totally get it. And so we kind of looked in the marketplace. I couldn't find one. And so I went to Waleed Basali, And he and Glenna Salyer had, I think it was called Thoroughbreds International, if I'm not mistaken. It was a breeding in, was that right? I think that was right. And Waleed actually had a season. And he said, gosh, you know, let's try, you know, maybe Mishawaki, maybe. And I said, oh, I really want Smart Strike. And he said, well, I have a mare named to the season, but I will take her off. It's my personal mare, and you can buy my season. And so that's what we did. And then, of course, it yielded Curlin. So we were very fortunate. The circumstances, you know, kind of unfolded and made him happen. And you know, I have to say, he was kind of a cheeky guy. He wasn't particularly stubborn, a nice big physical type, of course. But, you know, some horses you're around and you think, well, they've got obvious class and intellect. And I can't say that actually struck me. Curlin was kind of belligerent and difficult to manage as a foal and a weanling, even into a yearling year. And when we were trying to prep him, you know, he was a big, deep, heavy-bodied kind of yearling, kind of soft-bodied, actually, as a yearling, and was a little bit of a challenge.
You know, take us from there. He was a little bit of a handful, which seems very common. You know, I hear that a lot. On Dude comes to mind. I remember Bob Baffert saying that he didn't think he was going to be able to get him gate certified. He was such a head case.
Right. Well, you know, the thing with Curlin, he slept all the time. As a yearling, he slept constantly. And he'd stand in the walker. We'd try, you know, we had one of the gated walkers, and he'd let the gates just pass over him. I mean, he was belligerent in the challenge.
That's hilarious.
And so we ended up, one of our clients was Sweetwater Land and Cattle Company, and we ended up buying, I used an old AQHA off-the-track gelding that we brought back for him as a pony, and we ended up ponying him to get him to the sale. And he's a big gray gelding, and he reminds me a lot of Poncho, which was the horse that, you know, of course, Scott Blasey had, that accompanied Curlin everywhere during his campaign. So we kept him. We actually had Tex, even when I moved, we left Ferris Farm and closed the property, you know, Tex came and stayed with us, and he lived out his old age and spent time, but he certainly made his contribution, even though probably no one other than Steve Haskin, who wrote the article about Curlin, would probably recognize his contribution. But anyway, so we finally got him to the sale, and of course, Kenny McPeak bought him for $57,000. Fun story, if you care to read Steve's column at some point in time, talking about the ownership. You know, he was involved with the Cunningham Galleon folks and raced actually under their banner until his maiden debut at Gulfstream, which I'm sure you remember. Probably, Mark, you may have even been there.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yep. And then my phone started ringing because Omar Trevino called and said, hey, where's that mare? I said, what mare? Breeding season. We were busy. And he said, sheriff's deputy. I said, God, Omar, she's pensioned. You know, she had a cervical laceration. We had to do a perineal body reconstruction. You know, she grew a pseudomonas, a strep. If you're familiar with brood mares, you know, you realize there are a multitude of problems. And, you know, as near as age, obviously, gravity takes a toll, and lymphatic system starts to fail. So she was a mare that had what's called delayed uterine clearance. I mean, she was really, really a challenge. And so we were all too happy to pension her until Curlin came along, and we had to find a way to get her pregnant. And so that was right after we lost Dr. LeBlanc, which is such a huge loss for everyone. And then Christina Liu from Hagar Davidson McGee came. And she and her brilliant husband, Steve Morrissey, who's an internal medicine guy at Rood Little, you know, sorted out the sheriff's deputy and the systemic approach, you know, to getting that mare as compatible with carrying a foal to term. And we ended up getting a few additional foals, you know, out of the mare at the end. But obviously, lightning rarely strikes twice, so we failed to get another Curlin. But he certainly made his mark, and when I see a lot of the good horses that are out there, they remind me a lot, actually, of Sheriff's Deputy. Tenacious, big, tough, strong mare. And I see so much of her in his offspring.
That's so cool. And I love that. I mean, I think that it's always interesting to me to see the similarities between generations of, you know, bloodlines. I think that's really interesting to me.
Yeah, I love it.
People like you with the eye can see it even more than I can. you know, things that stand out.
Right. Well, you just remember them. You know, you remember their character and their constitution, their archetype, and then to go back and see it all. And now, you know, it's funny, I look through the catalog, and, of course, all my mares are gone now. So I'm in the third and fourth dam, you know, trying to pick up bits and pieces. But, you know, it's still there, and it's, you know, female families are just, they don't let you down. And that's the thing with Sheriff's Deputy. You know, she came from a very good, deep female family, and they might sleep for a little while, as she did. But, you know, they reward you. You know, you're patient, you take your time, and you wait. And generations later, they show back up again, and it just warms your heart. You know, it's a good story.
It's funny because, you know, they said the same thing about Secretariat, that he would nap all the time. And they said he was notorious for just standing around sleeping. And I know several other big, you know, the one that I always thought of that I was fairly close to when Bob was running him was American Pharoah. He was always pretty laid back. And it's amazing how many times some of these top producers are just, you know, they're a monster on the track, but when they're not, they're just kind of lounging around.
Yeah, they're recharging. And I used to, you know, I'd follow Curler, and I'd be in Saratoga, and I think the little girl's name was Amy. She was like his bodyguard. And I'd go to see him, and he's sleeping, you know, and he was down in the straw. I mean, he was out snoring, you know, deep, deep sleep. And I'd wait just to see him, you know, just wanted to see him. And she'd be like, no, he's sleeping. And so I said to Steve one time, I said, Steve, you know, maybe this is a, you know, maybe it's my lack of horsemanship. I really had kind of a tough time with Curlin. You know, I couldn't really get him tight for the sale. You know, you want a nice top line. And he kind of looked like a couch potato. And he did okay, obviously. But any time they ship over and they show, I wasn't displeased with him. But, you know, through his campaign, he never lost weight. He always looked fantastic. The rigors of training and shipping and going really didn't seem to affect him. And I said, what's your secret? And he said, Shannon, you know, we were just fortunate that we found something he loved to do. And I thought, you know, how true. I mean, Steve's amazing, and Scott puts in so much time with all those horses, and they are just a phenomenal program. You know, but seeing him and watching him, finally, I think it was Stephen Foster Day, I was standing in the paddock, Churchill, and I thought, okay, I get it. He's a beast. You know, took you a little while to see it, Shannon, but yeah, he's pretty impressive. And so now to watch and to see what he's contributed to the breed, and of course through Good Magic and his other sons, really, really exciting, and truly has been an absolute delight for myself, and I'm sure for Mr. Ferris as well, and everybody that was involved with him along the way.
And that is really fun. It's cool to see, you know, them go on and see what they do. I mean, obviously, I wasn't involved in the breeding side, but being, you know, involved with old friends for many, many years, it's funny now when you look at the racing program and you see, you know, these horses that you see on a daily basis up there, you know, obviously they're in the grand level now, but they, you know, they're the damn sire, the, you know, whatever. I mean, they were way back, and it's like, it's just, it's really interesting to me to see some of these bloodlines. When I first came to the industry, I didn't grow up in it like you did, and I didn't know a lot about it, and I still don't. You forgot more than I know. But I would go and buy old blood horse and thoroughbred times from like the 50s and 60s and just read them. And that was kind of how I started to get a little bit of an understanding of the bloodlines. And, you know, you don't, but it is, it's really, really neat to be able to see something like a Curlin that you were directly involved in.
It's really amazing. And I think when you've had success with a certain line or a certain group of horses, and they say this because I don't really buy as many horses as we used to be involved with, obviously, but I think, you know, you stick with what works. And, you know, when I first came to Ferris Farm, we had some grand old dames there. Fabulous Notion was there, and Rascal Lass, and Track Robbery, and, you know, those pedigrees are still alive, you know. And of course, that fantastic light at Lane's End, you know, and Paris Notion, you know, that whole family. And then, of course, I bought Supreme as a yearling from Jerry Dilger, who we all love and miss. And she was a great little turf sprinter for Mr. Ferris. And, you know, we took a gamble with her. She had some issues, proximal suspensory issues, but the Delacours were fantastic. She was a nice little graded stakes mare for us. And then she's got Silver State, obviously, you know, starting his career at Claiborne. So for me, that's so much fun to watch and just to see how the story unfolds, because it's some tiny little incremental part, you were there. So,
yeah,
you know,
there's a lot to that. I mean, it really does. And that is the one of the things that's fun about this industry is that you do get to see your work continue on for decades.
Right. And so I think the big thing is, you know, that you persevere and you believe and you find your conviction and the things that work for you and, you know, whatever chapter of your life you're in, because I'm 52 and still trying to figure out what I want to be when I grow up. But, you know, I had a great career at Rudin Middle. I loved my time in academia, loved my time at Ferris Farm, and now I'm largely a dog mom. But I ironically work with a dandy product. And we do most of the zoos and vet hospitals. They're, you know, surgical padding, floor recovery padding. And so it's a continuation of, you know, that chapter of my life. But I've known Dan and Colleen for 32 years, and they needed someone here, and that brought us to Wellington. So now my girls are all engaged in here, and it's exciting, you know. So I would tell young people, if there's something that you want to do and an interest, you know, just, God, follow your heart and go do it.
No, there's a lot to be said for that. I mean, we've all heard it a million times, but there is something to it. You know, if you enjoy what you do, you'll never work a day in your life. And
you bet.
I think they could never be more true than this industry. If, you know, the horse industry to me is similar to Hollywood, and I've worked in both. And, you know, with Hollywood, I've always said, if you're going into it for the money, the chances of being successful are not great. And I would say the same thing with the horse industry. You have to love it. You have to want to do it no matter what. And those are the people that generally succeed. And I don't know why or what that recipe is. I couldn't break it down that far. But I just, you know, like I've said many times, I don't have all the answers, but I've been sitting in the audience watching the show for quite a while, and you start to see patterns. And that's the one pattern I see. The people that are successful would probably do this for free. You know, the money isn't what drives.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They just enjoy it. They, you know, you know, most people that are successful probably did do it for free at one point.
You better believe it, or close to it.
Yeah. Yeah, they're close. Yeah, that's what I've heard. You know, people say, you know, the closest I was to being homeless was when I started in this industry. But it's funny, you know, it's like, yeah, I've heard people compare it to like Nashville and Hollywood. They're like, yeah, it's amazing how many times you have an old broken down car and $200 and you head for Nashville. And, you know, it's amazing how many times somebody has an old broken down car and $200 and they head for New York or Lexington. And it's like,
Right. Well, I think the industry, whether in music and acting, you know, it's more subjective. Thoroughbred racing, obviously, a very, very hard target to hit. But you do it because the optimism, the passion, and I think that's true with your career choices as well. But that does carry through. That energy certainly carries through. And, you know, I've been very, very fortunate in my life to be involved with some really wonderful horses and phenomenal people, and just great experiences all the way around. And, you know, tough, it's hard, financially, physically, emotionally challenging, but I can't imagine doing anything else.
So where does it take you today? So what are you involved in right now?
Well, here, you know, with Dan and Colleen Reed at Dandy, and so that's been fantastic because we service, you know, the thoroughbred industry, veterinary medicine, and then it keeps me anchored in 70-degree weather most of the year. We're here in Wellington, Florida. Yep. Did I lose you, Mark?
No, I'm right here. And so it keeps you anchored in 70-degree weather, which I can appreciate because you're coming to me live from Wellington. I'm at Gulfstream.
That's right. So we're here in the winter, and then, of course, in the summer, we're back in Kentucky. So I get to see friends and family in Kentucky, and then we spend a little time in Traverse City, Michigan at the Great Lakes Equestrian Festival. So that, and then we have a couple other little companies that my daughters and I are involved in, a wound care company, a nutraceutical company, and so, you know, still same thing. It's still patient care, products that solve problems and provide solutions that are FEI and RCI compliant. And so those are very, very important to us. And so that's kind of what I'm doing now. But it's, it's been a good career, a good pathway, and now I hope to share that with some other young people. Very, very passionate about that and trying to open up my Rolodex, connect people.
It's great that you get to work with your daughters, too. I mean, that's...
Oh, I love
that's
that.
That's got to be rewarding in itself. I mean, like any of us, you know, our kids are what drive us, and, you know, I know for me, I'd do anything to have more time with my kids.
It's amazing.
Being able to work with them is kind of a dream.
Yep. No, for years, we've been here for, I guess, 9 years. My youngest worked with Danny and Ron. They have a Danny and Ron rescue. There's a movie about them you may have seen called Life in the Doghouse. Take a minute and watch that. But she's been very involved with them for many, many years, but now away in college. Lauren did the media marketing here for many years when it was Palm Beach International and then worked for Traverse City Horse Shows. But now she's just finished an MPA in D.C., and she's doing her law school applications, another round to figure out what comes next for her. And she just took on the Helsinki Fellowship, so she'll start that in January. And then my middle daughter is here with me in Wellington working at Food and Riddle with Dr. Jen Jordan. So, I mean, I'm giddy because I've had so much time with these girls, you know, growing up and being here and being present, and that is probably the greatest gift. Curling was spectacular, and really enjoyed the horse industry, but spending that time with your daughters and watching them flourish is really very, very special.
No, I couldn't agree more. And that's one of the things that's really a gift with this industry, right? I mean, I'm the same way. I've been fortunate to be able to take my kids with me, enjoy many of the things that this industry brings, from the Kentucky Derby to Saratoga to Del Mar to Gulfstream. And, you know, they're all great, but there's nothing that makes it better than being able to enjoy it with your kids.
You bet. You know, my girls have never been to the Derby. So 2025.
Oh, wow. We have to fix that.
We've got to fix that. Yeah, we had, 11 Derby starters during my 13-year tenure at Ferris Farm. But the children were younger, and so we always had clients or, friends of the Ferris family come in. So they've never been to the Kentucky Derby. So I feel like Mom needs to remedy that and make that happen next year.
So I have to ask, what is your favorite race? You know, everybody has a favorite. Everybody has a favorite track. What would you say yours is?
You know, Keeneland is my heart and soul. I drove the girls to the Lexington School every morning through Keeneland, and just grateful to be there, thankful to be there, and great facility. I have to say, though, attending, I actually love the Preakness. I love the infield.
Okay.
You know, I love that it's a smaller venue. They always had great music. I think I saw Maroon 5 there and Bruno Mars there. So from the experience, that was a great experience all the way around. But gosh, Keeneland is my heart, and love being there. It doesn't even matter. We won the Double Dog Dare with a nice mare named Embersong. So that was probably my favorite race, honestly, other than, of course, Curlin's. But it's a great track, a great venue.
Let me ask you this. What was the first racetrack you ever went to, like even before you were in the industry?
Also Keeneland with my dad.
Okay.
I remember
that would make sense.
Parking there, and I just said, Daddy, this doesn't look like a racetrack. Are you sure this is? But I just remember following him to the apron.
Beautiful.
And I was maybe 7, 8. I was very, very young, but I still remember where we parked, remember the trees and the parking lot, and it just being, you know, just special. And then a lot of days followed Keeneland in my youth with my dad.
I think there's something to that. I mean, it's hard to tell what it is, but everybody, I don't think there's a wrong answer. Everybody has one track or race that's very special to them. You know, for me, it's Del Mar.
Saratoga, Saratoga's special. Oh, it's always a trip in August I take with my girlfriend. Sometimes work-related, sometimes not, but, you know, there's just a lot of great experiences around, and grateful to
get to do them. I love the stories at Saratoga. Saratoga is a unique series, a unique meet. In the fact that I love talking to people there and hearing why they're there. And it's amazing how many times you run into somebody out there by the picnic tables or walking around, and they've been coming there since they were little for 50 years. They started out coming with an uncle or their dad or their granddad.
Generational. It's generational.
And I'm sure that happens at every track, but it definitely seems more prominent there. I mean,
yeah,
it's,
I agree.
I've compared it, and I mean this with all respect, but I tell friends outside the industry about Saratoga, I said it's kind of like summer camp for adults. You know, it feels like, you know, everybody goes up there, and it's like they're away at camp for a month. It's like, it's just a different meet and a different feel that you don't have. I mean, I don't know if it's because it's such a small town and you just see everybody everywhere. You know, you'll be at the track, and then you run into people walking around at dinner time, and then you run into them in the morning, and then they always have the sale during the meet, so you run into them there.
Yeah, there's a small number of horses, so everybody from Lexington is there, you know, but you get through your short list, and there's time. You have time, and you don't have time in September or time in November or time during breeding season, you know, or prep season. But in Saratoga, you have time, and I think that is when people, you know, enjoy sharing that time and camaraderie, and, you know, it is very special. And I have to say, one of my other favorite places, Mark, and I would tell people, if you get a chance to go see it, just because I remember watching the races there, is Hialeah Park. I don't know what the fate, you know, what fate has in store for her, but I took my dad when he came down last year for Christmas, and I didn't tell him where we were going, and I drove him to Hialeah to see the fountain and all those placards with all those phenomenal horses that race there, and the stories and the photos of and Kennedy, and just really very Churchill, you know, very special. So it's a history lesson of sorts, but that is a really neat place to visit if you have time.
I agree. You know, the other one that reminds me of that is Santa Anita. And I tell everybody, if you're anywhere near it, take the time to go, even if it's not a race day. Because when you walk the halls and look at the pictures, and you realize that Seabiscuit walked through there, and you start seeing some of the names, it just blows your mind. I mean, it's such...
Well, and so the last time I was at Santa Anita is when Curlin was bested by Raven's Pass and Henry the Navigator. So my last visit to
memories aren't great. Yeah. It's funny you say that, because it was, you know, I had Big A Anthony Stabile on a few weeks ago, and he was the same way, because his beloved Songbird lost there.
Right. Oh my gosh. Yeah, it was a beautiful track. It's very, very special. And we're very fortunate to have some of these Grand Dames still around, you know, and still racing. Yeah. And I think the future of racing, you know, we've got to be better ombudsman of our sport, or we'll lose it. And all sports, you know, in general, involving horses, obviously. So
I encourage people all the time. Sure. You know, it's one thing I think, and I'm no expert, and this is just my two cents, it's probably worth one. And I think that some tracks have done a really good job of trying to do this, but I think the more that they can involve other things in the entertainment, you touch base on the music, like at Pimlico, you know, it the more Del Mar does that, and, you know, I know Gulfstream does that, and, you know, the more that you can have more than just the race on race day, the more that we can attract people for other reasons, the more that we can make it a, you know, dining and entertainment and horse racing events, I really think it is going to help the industry, because it has changed a lot. You know, I think with the opening of gambling and other sports, you know, for a long time, if a guy wanted to wager, this was the only sport. Well, that's not the case anymore.
Right. Well, and I think the farms have opened up their doors in Kentucky to recognize and educate. I think education is a big part. Transparency is a big part. And I think when people get there, just like, you know, so many, they love the horses. And, you know, we worked with Underhill Drive Studios. I tried very hard during, I think it was 2013, 2012, 13, 14, to work to, I wanted to build a documentary. You know, I used my old, actually, syllabus, so that each episode, somebody would learn the coat color, something, because I thought, as we brought people in, we educated them, and they were invested, you know, in the story itself, because the horses, there's such inherent drama in the horses and the stories they tell themselves. But, you know, I wanted to get it, you know, on television where people could follow their stories, you know, and then be there to see a horse make their first start and have watched from, you know, theoretical mating to conception to foaling, you know, the trials and tribulations that these horses go through and the success just to get them in the gate, just to get them in their first race and to understand the risk, you know, and the challenges that breeders and trainers face. You know, there is a very complex story and a lot of moving parts. And I wanted to involve the public. I wanted a very wide demographic. So, you know, 8 to 80, if you loved horses and wanted to understand more about our industry, that was kind of my passion project. And we got a sizzle reel done. We got some footage. And I just thought that was a really important story. We have to be, you know, we have to, you know, build our own narrative and share that story. And good and bad, you know, bad things happen in all industries, and but being able to be accountable for them and talk about them was critically important. So that might be part of my next chapter because
I couldn't agree more. And I think that is something that, you know, I think the difference is too, and I'm looking at it from the outside in because I didn't grow up in it. You know, we're a couple generations away from when horse racing was kind of the part of the fabric of society. And what I mean by that is, you know, if you look back at Hollywood in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, there was a reference to horse racing in almost every movie, every TV show, you can't watch a Jack Benny without hearing some reference to Santa Anita or Del Mar.
And, right,
you know, it came up in I Love Lucy. It came up in different, you know, even Andy Griffin. And, you know, and then along the way that kind of faded, and I couldn't tell you why, but, you know, I feel like, you know, the more that we can make people interested.
I think you're right, but I think Racing thought we had a fan base, you know, that was loyal, but we lost our presence on the radio, we lost our presence on television, you know, we didn't promote ourselves.
That's very true. I kind of agree. They kind of had their feet up on the desk and just thought, we've got it, and there's nothing we need to do.
Yep.
And it's a competitive market, right? You know, people are looking for different types of entertainment. And I think that's one of the reasons, and I'm not trying to pump it just because I'm around it, but I think that's one of the reasons Gulfstream has been somewhat popular is because it's more than just racing. It offers a lot of different things. And I think that, I mean, I'm really anxious to see what happens at Belmont when the new Belmont opens. Because
I think that's a unique
model. Yeah.
But I still think a couple things have to happen. I love what they're doing with the racing syndicates and the people, because whether you're a $2 bettor or you're a minority, you know, ownership interest, you have a vested interest in the animal. And
I
think people have to have a vested interest in the animal and their well-being, in their story, in their path. And I think that is a crucial piece because I'm not a handicapper. I mean, I'm a breeder. I love it from that standpoint. I don't want to bet. I don't find that interesting.
Well, you know, the problem is the closer you are to this industry, the tougher it is. You know, if you walk down the shed row, you're going to get 11 horses. You know, 10 people will tell you 11 horses that can't lose. You know, so you're more confused when you get done than when you started. You know, it isn't. The only time I've ever wagered is just for fun. Most of the time because I wanted the ticket. So I would wager, like, at certain races. Like, I have tickets from, you know, American Pharoah and, you know, Game On Dude and things like that just because I wanted to keep them. But not so much for the wager fashion. But you know, it's a... That's the beauty of this sport, and I said this one time. One of the things I love about this sport is that it attracts people for a multitude of reasons. You could be a fan of the horse, a fan of the track, a fan of the trainer, the owner, or the farm, or the race. Or you could be a fan of wagering. You could enjoy the hospitality. And the beauty of it is all those things are good, you know, and it's just a matter of bringing them together and making people aware of them. The other thing I would say in closing with our sport that I really think is a really unique piece, and I encourage people to check it out for themselves, this is one of the only sports where you can get up close and personal. You know, you touched on it that, it's about the horse. Well, this is one of the only sports where you can walk right up to the rail and be standing right there as they come running by for the finish line.
Right. And that's so exciting.
Where you could stand there and look over and see a Wayne Lucas standing there watching a horse next to you or some other dominant trainer. And they'll take the time to talk to you, you know, because they're, most people in this industry are pretty gracious and pretty giving of their time.
Sure. Sure. But, and we've got to tell the story. You know, I think that is a critical component. Tell the story, invite people in, because it's magical. You know, and these athletes are just incredible to be around. And again, we've got to be the best ombudsman, you know, on their behalf. And I think that is absolutely critical moving forward. I think it always has been. And the people who aren't don't need to participate. They need to fail. They need to leave. And identifying those people has been, you know, a major priority for the industry. And kudos to them for that. And I think, you know, moving forward, you know, it'll be a better sport for it.
I agree. And I think it's people like you that make it that. So I can't thank you enough for joining us today. And I really appreciate, you know, everything you do. Where can they find you? Let's go ahead and, you know, let's talk about what you're doing. Is there a website or something we can throw out there to help them find what you're doing?
You know, it's funny, and I'm old, and my girls make fun of me, but I'm always on Facebook. I keep up with everyone's marriages and births and daughters and, you know, all of the things that are happening in their world. That's probably the best way. Yes, we have, you know, obviously businesses
that we work
for.
You can find Shannon White on Facebook. Shannon is involved in everything, but, you know, a lot of experience and launching some new products. Take a moment and take a look. We really appreciate you joining us today, and, you know, I want to wish you and your family a very happy holidays. I know you got your girls
thank
home.
Thank you, Mark. And you as well. Fun, thank
sure.
you so much.
I hope you're getting some time to take some time off. I know you work about 8 days a week, but...
Well, that's true, but that's the nature of the horse industry in general, so that comes with the territory, and but I'm going home to Kentucky for the first time in 9 years. My girls, my brother, and my nephews, my sister, so we're super excited to have everyone
together.
Kentucky
Christmas, that's cool.
Yeah, family Christmas. So we're making a drive out Saturday.
Where do you guys go? What part of Kentucky do you go to?
Lexington is home.
Okay, so you'll go to Lexington. Okay, that's really cool.
Lexington is definitely home.
Okay, very nice. Yeah, and, you know, like you say, you know, go Cats. I lived in Lexington for 5 years. I love Lexington. I'm there a lot. And I got to tell you, it's funny. I've never seen a college that has more loyal fans than UK. I mean, you see college fans everywhere, but there's something special about UK. And UK fans are some of the most passionate. And you know, they're not rude. They're not mean. You know, sometimes when you say people, they have a really intense fan base, people get a little intimidated. But it's not like that at all. It's just the opposite. They're just truly, you know, love that college, love that team. I mean, when Calipari was there,
true good, true bad, very loyal. We bleed blue, Mark.
it is kind of funny, though. Now, their football's gotten better, so we got to give them a little bit of credit. But when I first started working in Kentucky, I would always say, I remember asking an old horseman, I won't say who he was, but it was really funny, true Kentucky gentleman, and I'm like, so who do you like for college? And he goes, let me explain something to you. If you live in Kentucky, you like Kentucky basketball, and you like Keeneland for football.
Oh, no. That's kind of true, because they run simultaneously, so it works.
They do. It's the only racetrack that every once in a while will give college scores during the race meet. I've seen it happen.
That's right.
Like on big game days, they'll actually give you an update and let you know what UK is doing.
Yeah, such a great town. Great camaraderie in that town. It's a kind town. That's home. I always tell people, you know, I'm technically a Florida resident, but please God, bury me in Kentucky to make sure that I get home, because there is no place like it. That is for sure. Kentucky is very, very special.
It is true. It's very true. I know my kids have, you know, a special bond with Kentucky, and in fact, my daughter is a senior this year in high school, Grace, and she has told me that that's her favorite place in the world. She loves Lexington. She loves being there. You know, my kids grew up going there with me running back and forth and then living there. And, you know, Keith and Grace both spent a lot of time there. And So it is one of those places that's just a special place. Well, yeah, thank you very much for joining us today. I can't
thank you for having me, Mark.
No, I appreciate it very much, and we can't thank you enough. We want to thank a few people. We support No Fallen Heroes here. If you get a chance, take a look. You know, it's run by a Top Gun pilot, Matt Wiz Buckley. NoFallenHeroes.com. He is doing amazing work to help veterans and first responders. We support Old Friends Equine, oldfriendsequine.org. If you're in Miami, go to the Palm Restaurant. If you're in New York, you have to go to King Umberto's. And we hope you get a chance to go see a race somewhere live. It's a great way to spend a Saturday or a Friday or a Thursday. So thanks for joining us. This has been Hollywood and Horsepower, and we'll see you again next week.